Hit it.
Today's Left of Boom episode is on bargaining preparation. It's part of our series of bargaining and strike preparation videos. We've got Phil McMahon and Dave Sapanoff, who are two consultants of ours that have negotiated hundreds of labor agreements. And they're joining us to talk. This episode is one of two where we're going through the preparation for bargaining negotiations. And then the second episode is the one on actually sitting at the table and bargaining. A lot of practical tips in this one. What kind of information should you be looking for? Who should be like at the table with you? What are some of the ground rules that you want to have? So really good tips for anybody who's preparing for bargaining. So enjoy this week's episode of the Left of Boom Show with Phil McMahon and Dave Sapanoff. All right, welcome Phil McMahon and Dave Sapanoff. We've got another episode in our bargaining series. Welcome to the pod.
Great. Thank you, Phil.
Yeah. So we've done a series of episodes around bargaining. And the main reason that we've started this whole series is because there's just a lot more companies that are finding themselves in a position of having to bargain a contract. And many of them are bargaining first contracts. And, you know, Phil and Dave are two of our consultants that do a ton of bargaining for our clients. And so we thought it would be really good to bring them in to talk about how do you plan for bargaining negotiations and what do you do around strategy planning for bargaining. So we've talked about project planning and we've talked about some of the other different kind of components, but we haven't really dug into the actual like getting ready to do your first negotiation or do a follow-on negotiation. So that's the main focus of today's episode. And I think, why don't we just start there? Maybe Phil, why don't you start with like, what are some of the key things that you want to do when you first get on the ground and are beginning a bargaining project? What are the key things that you want to get figured out as you're planning your bargaining?
Yeah. Thank you, Phil. So for me, it's kind of a multi-pronged approach. First and foremost, want to make sure that meeting with the senior leadership for the organization, both at the site, but also at the next level, whether it's at the same location or possibly at maybe the corporate office, if this is one of their locations, to coordinate and make sure that we have alignment completely on kind of really what the task is in front of us, what the timeline set, helping to set expectations so they're aware of how this process works and kind of the planning that's going to be required going into bargaining. You know, looking at all the different factors, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But for me, it's really just making sure that there's alignment amongst the the parties. Look,
why is that so important?
Well, I think, you know, having alignment, it just helps sets the expectation in terms of what the strategy is going to be. You want to make sure that you're aligned, that there's no surprises that come up in negotiation, that, you know, you might get thrown a curveball, but if you do the preparation and make sure that you're going about it in a meticulous manner, covering each and every area as it pertains to what's going to happen across the table, planning for the table, making sure that, you know, the team isn't caught off guard.
Yeah. Dave, how about you?
For me, one of the most important things is getting the management team comfortable with what's about to happen. Obviously, they've lost an election. If this is the first contract, potentially the first organized unit within their organization, there's going to be a lot of fear and trepidation about what's going to happen here. And, you know, a lot of people head into this with sort of the attitude, you know, I'm going to sit and listen to the union ask for things and ask for things. And, you know, I'm there to listen and take this all in and have to respond. I mean, the main thing I try to emphasize and get the management team comfortable with, number one, is that bargaining is a two-way street. The union's going to come in with asks, and I tell management, this is your opportunity as well to, in effect, develop your own bargaining goals and look at this as an opportunity to address and fix issues, organizational challenges, things that might have gotten you there in the first place, but obviously there were inherent issues. This is your opportunity to fix them as well. One other orientation I try and get management to think about is the fact that they're there to represent themselves now. And that's sometimes conceptually hard for them as they feel as if they have to protect certain employee segments and things of that nature. But the idea is approach this from a management perspective that you're there to represent yourselves, that the employees are still their employees. There's, you know, again, we're not talking about, this is not about retribution, getting anywhere in anything else. This is about, in effect, developing the mindset to come into a and come out with a fair and equitable agreement that allows you to run the business. And the other thing as well heading into this is to make sure that management understands is, you know, not to allow, as you head into this and develop your bargaining goals and strategies to listen to the union, allow the union in effect to define what you will be. Okay. You're in this in effect to make sure that when you exit the bargaining process, that you have an agreement that you can live with, work under, is good for you, good for the employees, and hopefully good for the union as well.
Great. That's a great place to start. So Phil, back to like alignment, I think maybe speak a little bit to like, how is this different than like a normal business negotiation? I mean, there's definitely similarities. So, but I think one of the issues that sometimes trips, you know, companies up, especially if they're going through it for the first time, is they look at, you know, well, this is just another business negotiation, but there's it's a little trickier than that. Can you comment a little bit? What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so it definitely is a little bit more tricky than that, because this is that, as a first contract, this sets the foundation in the bedrock, if you will, for all future negotiations having to deal with the employees at that location. So it's critical that the organization make sure that they understand the components that are going to be negotiated in the contract, as well as what language they can live with. As David mentioned, you know, ultimately the goal is to get a good contract, most importantly for the business, for the employees, for the union, but also making sure that you can still deliver to your customers' expectations and timelines, that you're not hamstrung in terms of your ability to run the business to make those critical decisions. So it's vital that you spend the time to really understand how all these pieces are going to play into one another, in terms of, say, like such as a management rights clause, scheduling, the ability to hold people over, possibly for overtime and things like that. So, again, you have the flexibility and the latitude to run your business the way you need to, albeit it'll be negotiated and discussed with the union. But you really need to start thinking, what are the must-haves that we need to get out of this contract to make sure that we have that latitude and flexibility?
Yeah. And I think, Dave, like, I think another part around alignment is authority, right? It's not just, you know, these are kind of priorities for us in this agreement, but there's also setting the, like, unlike a regular business negotiation where, I mean, it's not necessarily always easy to walk away, but like you can sort of propose some things and take them back, and you can do some things in a regular negotiation that would create like an unfair labor practice for bad faith bargaining if you did it in a labor negotiation. So talk a little bit about why is it so important for the business leadership to kind of like know how far they're willing to go, and like what is the no-go line versus maybe in a regular negotiation?
I think what a lot of people don't appreciate is just how legalistic the entire process of negotiating a labor agreement is. A lot of it's controlled by the National Labor Relations Act that, for the most part, most management team are unfamiliar with. You know, really, their first introduction to the NLRA was probably during the organizing campaign, but it also controls the entire bargaining process. So in a sense, then, how proposals are put on the table, how proposals or counterproposals are responded to, could put either management and or the union in some sort of legal jeopardy, commission of an unfair labor practice. Simple statements made at the table enable the union to potentially ask for a company to open its book, like, mm-hmm. for argument's sake, a simple response to an economic demand by the union of, well, that'll put us out of business, in effect, opens up legally for the union the right to request that the company open their books to them. So again, it's making sure that management understands the nuances of the law, and from both a tactical perspective, what we call table tactics, and then ultimately strategically where the negotiations end up, A lot of this is bound by the law. So, you know, every step of the way, every step of the process has sort of a legal push and take to it. You know, right down to something as simple as, for argument's sake, the union making an information request and fully responding to a union information request. Further on down the line, that if management has not fully responded to the union's information request, they will be unable to, you know, one of the strategic alternatives is potentially declare impasse in negotiations. So it's very important, again, that heading into negotiations, that management fully understands all the legal aspects of what goes into bargaining. What is good faith bargaining? What represents bad faith bargaining? Things of that nature, so that they understand sort of the limits on what can be said or not said at the table.
Yeah, and I think you bring up, you know, like a great example, but there's hundreds of others, but just something as simple that you would, in a regular negotiation over, you know, equipment or over a new software package or whatever, you know, the other side comes and they bring you, you know, they're like, this is how much it's going to cost. And you go like, we can't afford that. You've literally at that moment just said, come and take a look at all of our books to establish whether it is true or false that we could afford it. And you would never do that in a regular negotiation, but like simply saying those words at the table creates the basically obligation to prove or disprove that statement. And most people just don't understand. And that, like I said, is just one example of many that can be used to either require you to have to respond to information requests related to it, can be used as evidence of bad faith bargaining. So that's, I think, just the most important thing for someone who's kind of new to this is to understand all of this nuance. And the rules are not necessarily common sense. They're definitely not the way that you would handle kind of a normal negotiation. So I think that's kind of a really important, just foundational thing to understand. So let's switch gears, and Dave, let's go back to you. So you're getting started on the preparation for bargaining. What are the kinds of things that you want to collect? So let's just say management's pretty much aligned, but what are the things that you need as like tools in your tool chest, or, you know, information, or like what is it that you want to have collected before you get to that first bargaining session?
Kind of at a higher level, what we take management through is, number one, is sort of conducting an assessment of the collective bargaining environment. You know, what's the local economy like, difficulties in hiring, things of that nature, understanding the marketplace so that when you do an agreement, you know, is that agreement going to help you or hinder you in terms of attracting, retaining, and incentivizing, you know, the best employees, number one. Gathering and assessing as much industry data as you can. And I think from there, it's trying to gather as much information about the union itself, potentially the local, other agreements that they have with other employers, other agreements, not necessarily with that union, but with companies in your industry and also locally. You'll find that in local areas, a lot of agreements tend to look like each other. You know, over the years, companies have traded these things, unions have traded these things. So you can get a fair idea by looking at what the union has done elsewhere in terms of what they might come in and potentially put on the table as a demand for you. Again, one of the biggest aspects of this is also just understanding the financials. And this, to me, involves a very, and I can't overemphasize this enough, a very detailed internal economic analysis, which you call costing the agreement out. And this is truly understanding and being able to make it very simple so that you can do quick math at the bargaining table, but understanding the cost of virtually everything. Yeah. You know, what does 5 minutes of paid time off look like? What would an additional paid holiday or paid day off look like cost-wise to the organization? What does a 1 cent an hour increase look like in total dollars? What does a 1% increase look like in total dollars? And then understanding all of the roll-up costs and all of the costs associated with things like all of your fringe benefits, because obviously all of that goes on the table. And you want to understand, because again, just very quickly agreeing to, oh, an extra 10 minutes of wash up time at the end of the day, for instance, could carry with it a very significant financial impact. So those are the things that really I emphasize to management. Understand that in total before you head into negotiations.
Right. And then being able to counter, you know, proposals from the union where they're, you know, they, because they don't necessarily look at things that same way, right? They're thinking like that extra 10 minutes of time, that's like no big deal. And so then being able to go like, well, here's the cost of that over the life of this agreement. And then it also lets you go, this is why we can't agree to this other proposal. You know, you start to be able to use those details as arguments for why, you know, certain packages of stuff make sense, but this other package doesn't make as much sense because it costs, you know, twice as much. Even though if you were just kind of looking at the language of proposals, you'd be like, oh, these kind of seem pretty similar.
Yeah, I think it's very important that, you know, management understand that, you know, quite frankly, the union is going to come in and they're not going to be looking at your bottom line. What they are looking at as a political entity, they are looking to do, in effect, or try and fulfill promises that they made to the employees during the organizing campaign. So if that means asking for significant increases in wages and benefits, increases in paid time off, you know, all sorts of restrictive work rules and conditions, they're going to ask for them. And, you know, again, that's their job, so to speak, in the negotiations and their political responsibility to their membership. So, you know, again, I think any management team that expects them to come in and sort of respect the bottom line, respect profitability, I tell employers don't, because that's not their purpose.
Right. Phil, what are some other things that you kind of like to make sure there, you know, boxes that you got checked as far as prep leading up to the negotiation?
Yeah, for me, adding on to what David said, you know, I personally like to learn as much as I can about their operations, how the facility operates, what, you know, in a perfect world, what's a normal shift look like in your facility? Okay, now let's talk about some of the things that create some of the issues and problems that have come up. Through the organizing aspect, you know, there's probably been a lot of discussion and a lot of things brought up in terms of issues and concerns that the employees have, and why they're looking for, you know, to be represented by the union. And they were successful in getting the union elected. Okay, but moving forward, okay, now, what are some of those things? How true really are those issues? And what do we expect to hear across the table as it pertains to those specific items that, you know, you knew about? I think it's also critical to spend a lot of time with the frontline supervisors and leaders of the organization to understand what's really being said on the floor. What, you know, as best we can understand without, you know, interrogating or outright asking someone what's going on, but it's really critical to understand, you know, okay, the election's done. We've moved past. We're now preparing for bargaining. It's going to take a period of time. What's the scuttlebutt on the floor? What, you know, what are folks talking about? What is it that they seem passionate about? So that you can make sure that one, you're prepared to address that concern and issue when it's raised across the table, and two, okay, how could we, if we choose to, incorporate something in the contract language that could address that? Not being very specific, possibly in some areas, but in others, you would want to be very specific to addressing concerns and being prepared to address that.
And I think, you know, Dave, sort of building on your point, like you want to have, so there's the list of things that you know are probably going to be proposed because these were like the issues in the campaign that we just had, right? People were complaining about a bunch of stuff that they want fixed. They've now voted in a union thinking that the union's going to get all those fixed. So you can anticipate you're going to get proposals on that. The other thing a lot of times we talk about is, you know, there's kind of three lists, right? There's the list of the stuff the employees want. There's a list of stuff that management hopes to, you know, either retain as a management right or hopes to achieve as its bargaining proposals. And then there's this third list of stuff that the union wants institutionally, right? Like they want security, ideally, if they're in a state where that's allowed. They want a dues checkoff clause. So they want to make sure that their leaders you know, are the last people to get laid off. So there's these institutional goals also. And so a big part to me of the preparation is really starting to line out like, okay, what are the high priorities for us? What are the things that are high priorities for the union as an institution? And then what are the things that are going to be the highest priorities for the employees? And now you can begin to kind of start to see like what are the kinds of things that we might be willing to trade on our side in order for them to achieve, you know, something that's on their list. What's something that, you know, we could say no to on the employees list in exchange for the union getting something that's on its list. You know, that begins to kind of shape out what should our strategy be once we actually sit at the table. So I think those are to me some of the key principles. So any other kind of like prep items, like kind of before we get to the sort of tactics at the table, what are some other kind of like preparatory things that you like to kind of have in your pocket before you go in?
You know, along what Phil was saying in terms of learning the operations, meeting with management, expectations, things of that nature. I mean, again, it's this understanding of, you know, there are time frames as well. Is this, you know, management has to, in a sense, express its tolerance for various outcomes. You know, so for argument's sake, is the desire of the organization to reach an agreement quickly. There may be some sort of financial exigency that says mm-hmm. we want to. On the other hand, if management is saying, look, you know, however long it takes, that's how long it takes. Understanding that. Understanding that, you know, management may be in a position of saying, look, we are firm on these following things. And if it results in the union saying, you know, that's not, you know, that will not lead to an agreement, you know, is management philosophically prepared to deal with the outcomes and consequences of that? So I think, and again, and it's the job of, you know, myself or anyone else advising management to, in a sense, make sure that they are aware of all of the potential outcomes from negotiations so that, in a sense, they're able to develop the game plan for themselves as well and come to, you know, an end game that they are comfortable with.
Great.
I think for me also to add on that, I would say developing the strategy for where the actual negotiations are going to take place. I personally don't believe it's a good idea to have the negotiations at the company location. It should be separate and off-site because having it on site could lead to some disruptions within the organization. And you want, as David mentioned earlier, you want to kind of control the clock, the calendar, right? There's no specific timeline that you have to have this done by, but you want to have in your head a framework for how long do we suspect this is going to go on. So, you know, managing the clock is very important, having the resources available so that when you're at, say, the hotel and you're in the back room and you're working on things, that you have all the resources. And it's amazing how many times, you know, oh, well, we've got a printer and it breaks, or we have to have a copier or whatever, right? I mean, everyone has cell phones today, so communication's pretty easy, but just kind of making sure you have that avenue to have meetings and discussions back and forth between the plant and making sure they're aware of what's happening and what's being discussed. So you want to kind of lay a lot of that framework and groundwork down so that everyone's prepared.
A lot of that goes into, you know, I totally agree with Phil. A lot of that goes into the logistics here, the who, the what, the where, and the when. Establishing very early on, even before the first table meeting, you know, a single point of contact for both the union and for management. Because if you don't do that, what ends up happening is invariably the union is sending information requests, for argument's sake, to different people in the organization, some of which may recognize it for what it is, some that may not. And as a result, you've not responded to the union. I couldn't agree with Phil more in terms of basically saying we'll negotiate and pick a neutral site. I agree. Don't do it on the company premises. On the other hand, I do not like also negotiating at the union hall either. Generally speaking, the room gets arranged in a way that's disadvantageous to management. I wouldn't recommend that. And the other thing is agree on the logistics ahead of time with the union. For argument's sake, cost sharing for the hotel, food, if there's going to be any sort of refreshments, all of that. Make sure that before you
get there. Is anybody getting paid while they're bargaining?
Big deal. Big time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. You know, are you paying the union's bargaining committee to be there? Are they having to take paid time, unpaid time? Make sure all those logistics are agreed to. Another thing that sometimes you want to get to the table and talk about as well in terms of anticipating as a floating into the union is whether or not, for argument's sake, how will the union communicate with the membership? Mm-hmm. Will, you know, it, in a sense, taking any of the negotiations public.
Right.
So a lot of times you may want to, you know, have an agreement with the union that says, look, what we're talking about stays in the room. Mm-hmm. If you got to go outside, then we have to go outside. So let's just agree to keep it here if that's in the company's best interest.
Yeah, we had a whole episode with Nick on bargaining communications. And I think, you know, one of the things that we talked about there is just, you know, a lot of times you don't have control over whether things, you can get an agreement that it's not going to be public, but a lot of times it gets public anyway. So sort of anticipating kind of what that looks like. I love these like sort of practical logistical questions around sort of, you know, getting to the table. Let's talk a little bit about, like, if you've never done this before, like a lot of times a company owner, especially in kind of a smaller mid-sized company, is like, well, this is my company. I'm going to bargain the contract. Talk a little bit about kind of who are the right people to have at the table. Who are people that might think they should be at the table that probably shouldn't be at the table? What are your thoughts about that? Phil, we'll start with you.
Yeah, great question. So this is where at times it can be challenging, because although, yes, they want to be at the table, again, you have to make sure that you're having people who are the right people in the right positions to be mm-hmm. at the table. So for me, I typically do not want to have the leader of the facility or of the business at the table, because whoever ends up being the chief spokesperson, whether it's myself as a consultant or a representative of management, I always want to make sure that that person is viewed as the person who's in control. They have the ability to bind the company, that they're not looking to their left or to their right for acknowledgement or permission of anything that's being discussed and tentatively agreed to across the table. So for me, I prefer to have at the operational level, someone who knows the operation, knows the in and outs of it, so that when the union throws something out, we have someone with the credibility and ability to speak to it. The chief spokesperson, in my expectation, is typically the highest ranking HR person at the location, or possibly, depending on the size of the organization, it could be a region person, so that they have the credibility as well as the appropriate level to be able to bind the company. Then I always look to have, whether it's myself or someone else with the experience, to be there at the table with them to help them, and coach them and kind of guide them through the process. And then I also look to make sure that I have someone taking notes, because I think it's critically important, especially in a first contract, because, again, you're setting the foundation for the future contracts in the relationship going forward. It's critically important to me that you have someone capturing the notes as best they can, as clear as they can and precise, so that you have that record of the discussion, so that down the road, whether it's later in the negotiation process or possibly even a couple of years down the road, you know, really, truly, what was the intent? What were we talking about? How were we getting to where we were getting to? So to have that laid out. So that's kind of the way I look at the committee. And the only other thing I always, in talking with the union, you'll get an idea of how many people are going to be on their committee. I don't necessarily agree that the company committee should be as big as the union committee, but it should be relatively close. But again, the people who are at the table have to have a reason why they're at the table, in an expectation that they're going to participate, not just observe.
Yeah, I'll flip to Dave in a second, but like a couple of quick reactions to that. So the, I think you meant this, but it might some people might have heard it differently. You know, the reason sometimes that you don't want to have like the owner of the company or someone who is actually the final answer at the table is because you'd like to have the flexibility at times to be able to go, well, you know, like, look, I have authority to do this agreement, but like, this isn't something that we've really talked about. We're going to need to go talk about it. And it gives you a way to stop on that issue, pause. Maybe we'll talk about it next time after we've had a chance to consult with the ownership. But if the owner is actually in the room, you don't have that play available, right? Because like, they're there, they need to like make a decision. So that, I think that's number one. The other thing is, a lot of times, if you've never done this before, you know, you might think you want to be there, but if you haven't actually watched The Sausage Made, you probably should go sit through some bargaining before you decide, like, you want to sign up for, you know, a year and a half of these meetings, because it's very likely you will not want to do that. And then it starts to create an issue around, okay, well, you know, now the person who was the authority is, like, no longer showing up. You know, is that a bad faith bargaining move? So there's, you know, you want to get your team kind of figured out right up front. And it's very common that you might invite somebody in for a particular session because they have expertise in the issue that we know we're going to discuss this time, but you don't have to have, like, everybody there for every single session. So I think that's basically what you were saying, but I just kind of wanted to highlight that. Dave, what are your thoughts about the team at the table?
Agree 100% with that. It is always good, in my estimation, to have what I call hidden authority. You know, that idea that on particular questions, obviously, whoever is the chief spokesperson at the table has to have authority to be able to conclude agreements.
Right.
Agree to tentative agreements. That's why it's very critical that prior to any negotiation sessions, in terms of where certain issues are going to be brought up, that chief negotiator knows exactly what their limits are in terms of what they can and cannot agree to.
Yeah.
And they have to have, there has to be that authority at the table. Now, it doesn't have to be 100% of the time. There may be instances, you know, exercise, you know what, on that one, I'm going to have to go upstairs and get an answer on that. Likewise, as you were pointing out, Phil, in terms of expertise, you know, there are times you want to bring in, for argument's sake, benefits is usually the big issue.
Yeah.
Health and welfare, where you bring in the expertise to address particular issues at the table for understanding. So to me, that's one of the tactics that you use here, is to always have some level of hidden authority when you're at the table. That, and again, one other thing I emphasize to management, never feel obligated to give an instant answer to anything. Mm-hmm. And if you feel obligated, that's when I tell everyone to say, that's when that little voice inside you says, now it's time to take a caucus break and leave the room, ask for time, leave the room, have a discussion.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of, like, the key, and this again goes to kind of, if you're doing it for the first time, this doesn't necessarily make sense to you. Or if you've been involved in a lot of other kinds of business negotiations, this doesn't make sense. But you want to be, you know, when you finally say yes to something, you need to understand you're not going to, like, take, there's no take backs. I mean, under very extreme circumstances, but when you reach a tentative agreement on something, you're basically saying that's going into the contract, and it's going to take a lot to walk that back, and probably walking it back is an unfair labor practice. So, like,
that's an indicia of bad faith bargaining, is to, in effect, take back, walk back, or or unilaterally amend things that have been tentatively agreed to. So,
So it's like, it's really important then to be, like, 100% sure before you say yes. And so, like, the magic words are things like, well, like you said, let's take a caucus and then we'll discuss that. Help me understand that more. You know, I understand what you're saying. I believe I understand. Let me see if I can repeat what you're saying. You know, you're doing things to try to make sure you have a full understanding of what's being proposed, as opposed to saying yes to things. Take your time, make sure the words on the page are exactly what it is that you're trying to accomplish, that there's not any, like, tricks in there or even just vagueness that could later, they could say one, it means one thing when we all agreed at the time it meant something else, which goes back to Phil's thing about notes. Those are, like, really, really critical behaviors that probably in a regular negotiation you wouldn't care so much about, because you could change your mind in a regular negotiation and there's really no consequence to that. It's different in a labor negotiation. And then Phil, to your point on notes, I think people also don't really understand, like, those notes, two or three or maybe even, like, 10 years later, when there's some question about what a particular clause means. And again, unlike a regular business negotiation, the things that we talked about but didn't make it into the contract are critically important, right? Because that, you know, they can come back years later and say, like, well, what that actually meant was this, where you could go, no, we talked about that and right. we didn't agree to that specifically when we agreed to this clause. You can now prove, like, this interpretation, they already have agreed that that's not what it means. But if you don't have those notes, you are going to have problems when it comes to interpreting vague language.
Absolutely. And you could find yourself having to find yourself in an arbitration, or possibly even, you know, going up to a circuit court or something for interpretation, because something that happens 10, 12, 20 years down the road goes back to that original intent of the language. And if it's vague, even though you had an understanding at the time, the players have changed, the folks have changed. You know, it's going to be critical to protect the organization to have those notes so that you can go back. You're still going to get challenged on it, but that's fine. But at least you have a defense,
right?
As opposed to trying to come up with something or trying to find somebody who was there at the time. So that's why they're critical, and that you don't lose track of where the notes are going forward.
Oh. I mean, when I was a newbie in the industry, the old timers always would tell me, said the people that keep the side that keeps the best notes is the one that's going to win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I worked for an organization, and they ended up in a situation where there was some movement of work from one facility that was represented to a non-represented facility. And the language had a clause in there that said to make every reasonable effort. It was never a problem until 20 years down the road. Mm-hmm. And then it got interpreted by somebody else. And unfortunately, it wasn't in favor of the company. So it was a tough lesson to learn, but it's one I never forgot. And fortunately, I was on the sideline, but I learned it.
Yeah, I mean, and there, you know, there's places for vague. You said this earlier. There's places for vagueness, and then there's places for like specifics. And knowing where those should go is really, you know, an important skill. So we haven't really talked about legal and kind of where it fits into this whole, you know, the team. Why don't you talk a little bit about kind of like when you know, how do you work with the legal team? Kind of where do they fit in? Dave, why don't you start?
First of all, having legal counsel is, I think, very critical in any negotiation. There's always going to be an issue that comes up that, you know, again, is even beyond the scope of even people that have been steeped in this for many, many years. And, you know, for argument's sake, you know, starting off with something as simple as an information request. You know, the union is going to send an information request. Some unions will have a very simple two-page information request. There are other unions, depending on their aggressiveness, that may just pound you with multiple, you know, 5, 10, 15-page information requests, literally asking for information on every aspect of the business. And it becomes very important, using this as an example, for the company to understand, you know, is the information request, for argument's sake, relevant? Is any of the information that the union's asking for confidential? And, you know, understanding the legal nuances. And this is where somebody very steeped in this is very critical to understanding that. Understanding how to respond to certain proposals, you know, in effect, crafting language back to the union such that it doesn't come off as a refusal to talk about something, but again, expressing no interest is, again, two different legal things. Unfair labor practices in terms of commissions at the table and things of that, and, you know, when, for argument's sake, you know, in terms of what we call mandatory, permissive, or illegal subjects of bargaining and what the union may put on the table. I'll give you a perfect example. I'm in a first-time negotiation now with a union that came to the table, and in the recognition clause, attempted to add in a job category that was not part of the NLRB certification. Mm. And the management team there that had started the negotiations on their own suddenly realized, kind of, we're out of our league, brought me in to then pick up the negotiations for them. And, you know, again, they didn't understand something to the effect that something as simple as adding a job title into a recognition clause, that's a permissive subject. And all, you know, and they didn't understand, again, as most people, you know, you say, sorry, but that's a permissive subject. And, you know, we're not going to talk about that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just understanding those nuances. But again, having good legal counsel here for when these types of questions come up is very, very, very important. And one other place where it's super critical is if at the end of negotiations, you are potentially building towards impasse, running counsel through all of the steps that have been taken, all of the issues, how they're responded to, whether or not the picture is complete as far as responding to all the union information requests becomes very important. And I think legal counsel serves a very, very important purpose there in making sure that the T's are crossed, I's are dotted before impasse is declared and possibly an imposition of management's last, best, and final offer, you know, all of it or part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how about you, Phil?
Yeah, I agree with David 100%. I think, you know, for me, it can go a little different way depending whether you're dealing with internal counsel versus external counsel. Mm-hmm. Again, depending on the expertise of the counsel. Some organizations may not have a full-time attorney on staff, so you may be dealing with outside counsel. So to me,
very few companies have like in-house counsel that have negotiated a bunch of labor agreements.
Correct.
Now, if you have a lot of labor agreements, then you have that. But if you're a company who's kind of lost its first election, even if you have a general counsel and even if you have a, you know, in-house like employment counsel, it's still very rare to have somebody that has done a lot of labor stuff. And as we've already been talking about, like it's going to be critical to have someone, you know, whether it's in-house or outside, that knows this law, because the law is changing all the time. So absolutely. I interrupted. Go ahead.
No. To piggyback off that, I mean, even you know, having a relationship with that individual, so that you know, you prepare them for what the plan's going to be. You get alignment with them that, yep, the strategy seems spot on. I like the approach. Be mindful of this and that. Again, they may be thinking of something that you haven't thought of, or maybe they ran across something. Or to your point, maybe you know, the law just recently changed, which seems to be a common occurrence. Much more frequently than it has in the past, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's for sure.
Well, one of the things, and we're sort of like getting in a little bit to like our next episode, which is on just like the actual bargaining at the table. But from a strategic standpoint, you also have to think about. So, for example, you know, the law recently changed, and it'll probably flip back. But there's this whole back and forth around, if something's not in the agreement, has the union waived its right to bargain over that? And this is a football that goes back and forth, but unfortunately the contracts last, you know, longer sometimes than the administrations last and can like flip this football back and forth, which means like your strategy around the drafting of proposals probably needs to assume that at least during some of the time, the interpretation is going to be, there's got to be a clear and unmistakable waiver, or you're going to have to bargain with the union. And like in the middle of a contract, the union has a right to just go, yeah, we're not going to bargain over it. We'll see you in 2 or 3 years. So things like that are, you know, most companies don't know. You have to be doing this all the time to even kind of recognize this as an issue, and it changes. So it's really complicated.
Very complicated.
Yeah, extremely complicated. And really, when you're sitting and writing proposals, to a lot of people, the nuances that go into a labor agreement, you know, a sentence that ends in a period will be completely, you could take that same sentence and instead of a period at the end of the sentence, comma, et cetera, can change the whole meaning of a sentence. And that's lost on a lot of people in terms of looking at a labor agreement and what a simple difference like that may make.
Yeah. And that's another good reason to have a lawyer looking at proposals, just as a, you know, even in cases where we're bargaining at the table. We have clients that do it a lot of different ways. Like if you've never done this before, you should have somebody that knows like a lot about this that is ideally in the room. And that could be us. That could be your outside counsel. If you have an in-house counsel that has a lot of experience, it could be them. But you don't want to do this with people that are like doing it for the first time. You still might have like key leaders that are in there, but that's not who should be quarterbacking. But however you design your team, you really need, like, you need a strategist, you know, you need the legal review, and then you're going to need the in-house experts to be able to respond to things that the union's proposing. But you, like, it's not optional to have those different folks. And then at some point, yes, you might also need communications help. That depends a little bit maybe on the client size and sort of what kind of business they're in. But you know, those core elements of sort of bargaining strategy, legal, and then sort of the in-house, you know, company experts, those are all critical. So let's I think, yeah, we're getting close to the end of this episode. So strategy wise, I think one thing, and Dave, you kind of like started on this, but I think part of the strategy is timing, right? It's like, mm-hmm. when ideally would we like to be able to get a deal? There's probably also times that you would not like to be in a position of, you know, impasse, potential strike. You know, there strategically, there's going to be times where, like, the union, if there's going to be a strike, they would like to time it at this period. And if there's going to, and the company would like to time it at a different period, or you want to set your contract expiration to be at a particular time that's going to be like less of a concern for you than it would be at a different time. Maybe walk us through a little bit about sort of how do you think strategically about the timing of the bargaining?
I mean, when you look at the length of bargaining, how long it may take, you know, that's one of the things I always go over with management and says, what would be the optimal period if you were to reach an agreement? When would be the optimal period and time to reach that agreement and then to have the contract expire? Obviously, for management, you don't want to have contracts expire during peak busy seasons. Mm-hmm. I am negotiating an agreement right now with an employer that has a second location organized by the same union on the other side of the state. And that expiration is coming up in late February. And we have been in negotiations with this other location. And, you know, the employer is, you know, obviously very concerned about having two contracts that would expire literally within weeks, if not days, of each other, potentially. So that's one of the things strategically that we're looking at here is when and where and how do we try and conclude these negotiations sooner or later. So those mm-hmm. are considerations. So busy periods, obviously, you take into effect expiration of other agreements. If you have them as an organization, take those into effect. You know, expiration dates at the beginning of the month, at the end of the month, things of that nature. Because again, strategically, on, like, for argument's sake, a strike, and knowing that if people were to go out on strike, when benefits might expire. Mm. So, you know, a contract that expires at the very end of the month, the employee strikes soon thereafter, or maybe the first day of the next month, they have an entire month of benefits available to them. So these are all little typical nuances and details that you will look at and take into account in terms of the bigger picture as to whether or not to try and accelerate negotiations or try and extend them out. And one other thing that a lot of employers look at right now also is that the union comes in with a one-year protected period under the NLRA to negotiate a first-time agreement. And the question is when is that and where are you in the negotiations process such that will the union be actually negotiating without the benefit of having the protected period anymore? Mm-hmm. So all sorts of nuances and details in the timing that you would take into account.
Right. Phil, how about you?
Yeah, I think, you know, for an organization that has multiple locations, and maybe this is the first one where they've had, you know, organizing activity and they now find themselves having to negotiate a union. I also, from a strategy standpoint, like to see what's happening at the other locations to make sure that you're not, you know, as you build your strategy for negotiations, you're building it in the time frame that you're not rewarding others to possibly think that it could be in their best interest to do the same thing. So, mm-hmm. you know, possibly as it comes around in terms of the time of, you know, a general increase. You know, I wouldn't want to have a contract being negotiated where, you know, the folks at the facility that are represented are going to be getting an increase a month or so prior to the folks in the non-represented locations. Yeah. Being very mindful of the 1-year bar, if you will, period that David mentioned, where the union has the right to come in and negotiate. I'm always very cognizant about that. And for me, my strategy has always been, we're going to build a timeline for what works best for us, mm-hmm. and what supports the business to the best case that you can possibly. So possibly you're going to go 14, 16 months, right? You're not going to drag it out just for the sake of dragging it out. But, you know, again, the criticality of this first contract and laying the foundation to me is very important, and one that, you know, we need to do, take the time to do everything to lead up to the negotiations, to work through the negotiation process. And you kind of, you know, one of the things that I try and do is work with the end goal in sight and then work your way back to where you are today so that you can build your timeline that way. Best case, yeah. you know, it'll take us 16 months. Okay, fine. If that's best case, let's put it on the calendar. Let's work it backwards so that we have everything staged leading up to that period so we can execute to the timeline that's best for the business.
Yeah, good. I mean, I think, you know, people say, you know, well, you know, the reason negotiations take so long, you know, is because companies are dragging their feet. But that's rarely the situation. It takes two to tango. You have to get like a lot of people's schedules to mesh to be able to do it. These first contracts, you're literally bargaining every single page of that agreement. You know, there's no words on a page to start with. So you are like proposing all the different pages and all the different words. And that takes a lot of time. And you want to be careful about that first contract, because like you say, that sets the foundation for everything in the future. So the strategy of getting that first agreement right is so critical. And, you know, I think a lot of companies, especially if you haven't been through it before and don't have like a lot of experience with this, they don't really understand, you know, this isn't something where, well, we'll try it on our own for a while. And then if we don't feel like we're getting where we want to be, then we'll hire expertise. You know, once the bargaining gets started, you know, whatever strategy and preparation you did at the beginning, like that is sort of set. And, you know, coming in the middle, it's kind of hard to unwind things. So Dave, you brought up the example, right? Like if there's a clause that's already been agreed to, even though it includes permissive subject, like you unwinding that is going to be very challenging and probably an unfair labor practice.
So no getting that toothpaste back in the tube, that's for sure.
Exactly. So I think that's why it's like just really important if you're in the situation where you have just lost an election and you're in your first negotiation, make sure that you have somebody who has done this a lot that is like at least helping you get prepared. Even if you have the thought that like, I think I can handle this, or maybe you've even been involved in some negotiations before, you know, the law is changing all the time, the tactics are changing all the time. You know, there's some tried and true stuff, but like you want to make sure that you got this first one right. Because it sets the tone for, you know, your company for decades to come, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I think also, and I know I would stress too, is even though it takes time and planning and everything else, but the communication, and I know Nick did a piece on it and I'm sure covered this, but just don't ever lose sight that they're still your employees. They were your employees long before the union got involved. Mm-hmm. They're still your employees and you have an obligation to do what's in the business's best interest, but also theirs. So
yeah,
I think don't lose sight of that, because sometimes I think that does get kind of pushed off to the side.
Yeah, great point. I think that's a great place to end, actually, right? Don't forget, these are, you know, you're a lot of times a union will negotiate things. They don't necessarily understand your business. They don't necessarily, you know, they're hearing from maybe some, you know, small group of people that are like annoyed by this thing, but don't really have an appreciation for the impact culturally or the impact business-wise that this change would have. So it's really up, the company's the only one that's going to be able to kind of hold the line on stuff like that. So I think that's a great point. Is like at the end of the day, this is really about a contract that's going to help this company remain successful and make sure that those employees are taken care of. And that ultimately should be the goal of any negotiation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Great. Well, Phil and Dave, thanks so much. We're going to do another episode about like the actual sausage making here in a minute. But this has been great for bargaining preparation. So thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you. Thank you.